pause for a moment in your daily life and consider how different it may be from what it was like 2 decades ago. There's a good chance the internet plays at least some role in your life now, and it probably didn't pre-2000. Just imagine telling your grandparents back then that you'd be able to watch TV on your telephone and that your telephone could leave the house. The future can be scary, especially if you're on the verge of starting a career. Our first guest worked in the tech industry and will talk to college students at Southern Oregon University today. Steve Brown worked at Intel. He is now the CEO of Possibility and Purpose, LLC, and he gives many talks around the country, billed as the bald futurist. Self-applied term. Steve Brown, thanks for joining us in the exchange today. Yes,
the power of radio, and everybody can see my lovely shiny pate.
We should just tell you have rock star hair. It looks like it's the 80s in here. So it sounds like you're often talking to organizations about how they can prepare for the future. How can college students joining those organizations help those organizations even more?
Well, I think bringing a different perspective. A lot of the organizations I talk to are run by people who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, many of them progressive and understand technology and what technology can do. Many of them can't. And so I always encourage younger people who are going into an organization to speak up and challenge the way things are done and say, well, how couldn't we do this on a phone? Couldn't we do this in the cloud? Couldn't we do this a different way? Millennials in general are driven by a desire to make the world more efficient, and I'm right there with them. I'm not a millennial, but I feel like a millennial. I behave like a millennial. I think millennials have a lot to bring to the workplace by encouraging thinking about a different way of doing things. And so I'd encourage people to be polite, but speak up and help people who have maybe been in your business for a long time to challenge the way things have been done and look for a new, easier way to do things.
Probably best to get the job first, though, right?
Yes, definitely get the job first. And that's going to be a challenge. You know, if you're coming out of college now or in the next few years, the world you're going into is very different than the world that the teachers that prepared you lived and grew up in. And they, you know, they may not have got you completely ready for the new world. You're going to have to do some of that yourself. And it is a world where soft skills are going to be really important. The hard skills that you typically learn in college or university are only part of the solution. And you're going into a world where you're going to be competing against robots and algorithms. And robots and algorithms will be your coworkers. So I will say the new diversity in the workplace is humans and machines working side by side.
So it seems like there are so many jobs now that we once assumed needed to be done by people. And I'm even hearing about things like reviewing legal briefs and stuff like that can be done by algorithms. And so, I mean, it makes us wonder, it makes anybody wonder, particularly those who are heading into the job market versus leaving it in a few years, what will be there for them? I mean, if the assumption is that almost anything can be done by machine, what do they prepare for?
Yeah, and there will be a lot of jobs that will go to machines, but there will be a lot of jobs that do not. And so the trick is make yourself robot-proof. And to do that, you have to focus on the types of jobs that are very difficult to automate. And you're probably thinking, well, what are the jobs that are difficult to automate? Anything, at least right now, that involves manual dexterity, robots are still not very dexterous, and they probably won't be for a little while. So anything that requires heavy dexterity, anything that requires creativity, so critical thinking, creative skills, artistic skills, engineering skills, so all of the STEM sciences are looking pretty good. Anything that is a very varied set of tasks in a job. So if your job is repetitive, no matter how complex the task is that you're doing, but it's very repetitive, that task is a candidate for automation. I'll give you an example. Radiologists are at risk. Now, not all of what radiologists do is at risk, but the task of looking at radiology charts and looking to find tumors or other things that would indicate there's some sort of malady, that task is very likely going to go to AI in the next 10 to 15 years.
And when we're talking about radiologists, we're talking about actual MDs. I mean, these are people who went all through medical school and then added the radiology.
Right, and paid a fortune for their education and went through residency and have incredible experience. But that experience can be reduced to an algorithm because of some significant advances that have gone on in both computer software and hardware in the last 5 years.
Is there anybody at the end of that chain, for example? I mean, is there still one lucky human being who gets to be the radiologist who reviews the work of the radiology algorithms and figures out that they might need a little tweaking here and there?
I think there's some of that. And also, I don't think it will completely go. Radiologists don't just review charts. There are other things that they do. And those things will still be there and valid. But what will happen is that that part of their job, the diagnostic side of things, may go to an algorithm, which will be their assistant. So the radiologist's assistant will be there, and then all of the human work of talking with other humans, including patients, to explain what the diagnosis is, that remains human. No person wants to be told by a machine that they have stage 3 liver cancer. They want a human to deliver that message and deal with the empathy. So any job that involves empathy is in really good shape as well.
Steve Brown is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He bills himself as the bald futurist. He'll be speaking at Southern Oregon University today at 10:30. Do you know where?
Stevenson Union.
Okay, right in the heart of the SOU campus. You can join us now on the Jefferson Exchange. Help us shape the future right here and right now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So it sounds great up to a point that the rote tasks that probably would have given us carpal tunnel anyway are probably disappearing from the face of the earth. But then it continues to have people wondering, well, okay, I'm not really great at science or math. You know, I'm good at working with my hands. What can I possibly do in this new economy?
I think make sure that you're good at working with people, because the jobs that are about people working with other people, customer service, interactions where you are looking after somebody, or you are collaborating with other human beings to come up with creative solutions, those sorts of jobs are still going to be around. And so, you know, invest in building your communication skills, invest in building your personal networking skills, invest in building your ability to, you know, come up with great new ideas.
Is the educational system up to the task, you think, of preparing people for the future? I mean, given how fast things change, and I've had a couple of these discussions with people who work in high schools and colleges, but it seems like that by the time a cohort of students has come and gone in the 4 years, that the jobs that were the things they were training for at the beginning of that time are different already by the end of their time in school.
Yeah, and I think the educational system is able to respond. I'm having conversations with a number of educational establishments here in Oregon, and they all understand that this is an issue and that they need to respond. So they will respond. I think when domain subjects are moving and changing rapidly, so if you're on the forefront of computing, for example, yes, when you first start your four-year course, maybe by the end of it, the stuff that you learned on year one is not as relevant anymore. But learning how to be empathetic and to communicate and talk with other human beings, those are the skills that aren't going to change much. They just need to be added into the mix so that whatever discipline you're learning, you're also learning some of the humanities, you're learning some of the soft skills. Let me give you an example. If you are designing a self-driving car, self-driving cars are going to be hitting the roads as early as next year, and they're going to be in volume in the, you know, through the 2020s. Developing a car today requires lots of different people to work together. You have, you know, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, ergonomics engineers, industrial engineers, all of those people come together. You're now going to have software engineers going into that mix, but you also need psychologists. You need people who know about ethics to start getting into that mix, because you have a much more complex problem to solve. If you have a car that is out of control because of some mechanical fault, and it has to make a choice, do I jump up this sidewalk and mow down these three children? Do I go forwards into oncoming traffic and kill my passenger, potentially the oncoming? Or do I go up to the left and destroy property? You have to make that decision. That's an ethical decision. So you start to have to bring all these disciplines together. And so creating engineers, for example, but it could be any of the sort of hard disciplines of learning information, let's say, they are all going to need to have additional skills like ethics, like psychology, like, you know, some of the soft skills.
That was my next question, is whether there are people who are actually blending those skills in job titles now, whether there are people who are like, you know, ethics engineers.
There are machine ethicists. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're starting to show up. But we're only just getting into the time frame where artificial intelligence is moving into positions where you're making big decisions that humans used to make. And when you're getting into an area where a human used to make a decision, very often there's an ethical decision that has to be made there. So that's why this field is just starting to emerge. But we're going to have organism design people. We're going to have, you know, world builders, all sorts of new job titles that just don't exist today, but will be very big 10 years from now.
Are you confident that industry is taking the necessary steps to make sure that once a loop is closed, once the, you know, although the robots or computers are locked into doing their thing, that there is still somebody who can occasionally review the ethics of it, make sure that that all the machines are doing the work they're supposed to be doing, that people aren't getting hurt in the process?
I don't think we're there yet, because it's not really rolling out in, it's not a huge rollout yet, but it needs to be there. I mean, I think we're moving to a world where we will all be managed by machines, and we will all be managers of machines, whether those machines are algorithms or algorithms in physical form, which is robots and drones and all the other forms of them.
Stephen Brown is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He bills himself as the bald futurist. He's speaking at Southern Oregon University on the future of higher education. He speaks will be today at 10:30 at the Stevenson Union, but you can join us here now on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe you have a few thoughts about the future and how we should be approaching it, or questions for Steve about the things he's learned along the way in many years at Intel. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. From your own experience and visits with audiences of different ages, are young people as concerned about the future as their parents and grandparents are?
No, they're really enthusiastic about the future. And I try and focus on talking to younger audiences quite a bit. It's the best part of my week when I do that, because, you know, when I talk about robots and drones and artificial intelligence and augmented reality and virtual reality, their eyes light up. They are just so engaged, and they're thinking about all the possibilities to reimagine education and to reimagine healthcare and what their role will be in that. People who are a little bit older have watched a little bit too much sci-fi and are worried about, you know, because they've seen Terminator.
They've seen the machines take over, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, Hollywood does a fantastic job of doing dystopian science fiction. You know, Blade Runner's about to come out, 2049.
Right.
I can't wait to see it, and it's going to be brutal. But that's entertainment. Because, you know, when you're telling a story, there has to be tension in the story. If the story is, well, technology comes along and the world's a better place, it's not a very exciting film. So we have all watched too much science fiction, and thus we are a little bit too worried. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't pay attention and make sure, because when you're thinking about the future, there's two questions you have to ask yourself. One, what is the future I want to build? And second, what's the future I want to avoid? And you need to pay attention to both those questions, but we mustn't let the dystopian worry paralyze us from moving forwards.
I had composed the question, actually, about the age groups and relative fear of the future before I noticed on your website that you were present when Intel got virtual reality goggles on a 100-year-old man recently. Tell us about that.
So there's a gentleman by the name of Lyle Becker, who I have known for 20 years. So I moved from England 20 years ago. And when I first met Lyle, he was a young 80-year-old. And Lyle is, he and I have stayed in touch. He's a friend of mine. And he is one of the biggest followers of my blog. And if you're interested out there, baldfuturist.com/blog, he reads it and comments on it. And he was interested to try virtual reality. And so a few strings were pulled, and we got him into the VR lab at Intel. Lyle used to be a pilot during World War II. And so he was able, we gave him a virtual reality simulation of being in a plane. And he was able to fly a plane for the first time in probably 50 years. And this is a guy who, when he was young, went to school by horse. Grew up in a house on the prairie, literally, with no electricity till he was 12 years old.
Wow, born 1917, sure.
Yeah. And so what he has seen in his life is amazing. But he took to virtual reality like a duck to water. He absolutely loved it.
That's excellent. It was fun watching him on the video. It's definitely worth a watch at thebaldfuturist.com/blog. Past virtual reality, you mentioned mixed reality in your work, too, which is what?
So virtual reality is when you strap on one of those headsets and you're completely immersed in a digital world. Everything is synthetic. Augmented reality, you're starting to see show up on the latest phones. It's the ability to look at the physical world using the camera on your device. It can also be done with headsets that overlay digital information on the physical world.
Like Pokemon Go.
Yeah, Pokemon Go is a perfect example. Mixed reality goes a little bit further. Mixed reality is a bit more, it's a more sophisticated version of augmented reality, where not only are you overlaying information, but you are understanding everything in the physical world and blending them in a way that looks realistic. So, for example, a digital object might run behind your couch. So it's the computer understands the physical area in 3D and can blend things to make it look like digital objects are going behind physical objects. So it's a much more sophisticated version, and it leads us to an era where we will have both physical and digital objects in our lives. And apps become objects. So instead of having a weather app on your phone, for example, you might have a weather object that sits on your nightstand, or on your coffee table, or on the dash of your car.
I talked to somebody about the Internet of Things a while ago, about things like umbrellas that would flash on the days when rain is forecast. Is this the kind of thing you're talking about?
It's a different thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's sort of smart objects that are connected. The umbrella you're talking about is from MIT's Media Lab. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine called Dr. David Rose came up with that, him and his team. And he calls them enchanted objects.
Yes.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
A lot of fun. Stephen Brown, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Jake in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, yeah, thank you for taking my call. Just a really fascinating topic. My curiosity is, what do you think is going to happen to the middle class, the middle working class, in the next, 20 to 25 years, as automation advances and a lot of the, staple manufacturing jobs that support a lot of families, and that, averagely educated individual. Do you see that as being a threat to, just our stable economy right now, or that was really my curiosity. I can take the comments offline. Thank you.
Sure. Good question. Thanks for that, Jake.
Yeah, thanks, Jake. I think it's a little too early to tell. There's a lot of discussion about how deeply is this going to cut. At some level, we have been experiencing automation for hundreds of years, since the turn of the Industrial Revolution, and we've managed. We've always worried about jobs being replaced, but we're not making buggy whips anymore. We're not making fax machines much anymore, and that's okay, because we've moved on to doing other things. If you look back at the 1800s, most people worked the land. 80-something percent of people in the U.S. worked the land, and it was miserable, tough work, dragging a piece of rusty metal behind a sweaty beast, as one of my futurist friends says. If you lived to 40, you were lucky. So those people are now web designers and making lattes at Starbucks, and that is a good thing. But they resisted at the time. We are going to go through another wave now. My concern is not that we're going through more automation. Generally, that is going to lead to more new jobs that we just don't know what they are yet. My concern is the speed this is going to happen. This wave is coming and coming fast. And are we going to be able to retrain people to be able to do the new jobs, whatever they are? And are we going to be able to train people to work alongside robots and algorithms? I think it's also a philosophical question for business leaders. Business leaders who are looking at automation need to think about how they do that. I think if they are looking at their pocketbook and pocketbook only, they will have a knee-jerk reaction. Well, let's automate everything we can and cut costs. And that is really old thinking. I think people should be intelligent about looking at automation, but you're going to eradicate the humanity from your brand. You're going to eradicate the humanity from your organization's ability to serve customers. And so the smartest business leaders will look at this as an opportunity to build new teams, where those teams are collaborations of humans working alongside robots, working alongside algorithms. And the smartest companies will maintain humanity in their workforces and train their workers to work alongside the machines and get the most productive teams, but make sure that they're not going to lose the humanity in the system. If they do that, if you automate your company to the point where you've automated all the humans out of the system, your competition can do just the same. And then how are you differentiated? The only differentiation that companies have is the humans that work for them and the humans that make their brand what it is. And so Jake, it's a great question, and I've given you a long, rambling answer, but it is a very complex thing that I'm going to talk about for an hour this afternoon. So I'm trying to give you a few little tidbits of everything I'm going
to
talk about.
Stay human seems to be a major goal here.
Yeah, and I think for people who want to remain relevant in the workforce, double down on your humanity. You know, brush up your communication skills. Make sure you're empathetic. Improve your customer service skills. That's what will make you relevant and hireable.
Do you see a major rejiggering of the way we allocate labor, particularly in hours? I mean, because you look at the fact that there are people who seem to really be struggling to find decent work that will pay them well versus the people who do have jobs and are working way too hard at them.
Yeah, I don't see that happening yet. I mean, that was a big conversation in the 1970s, right? We'd all be on the three-day week, and what were we going to do with all this leisure time that we had? But, you know, we all got greedy, and we all decided we wanted to work 5 days a week, and our employers wanted us to work 5 days a week because they didn't have to hire two different sets of people. And it hasn't happened yet. If it didn't happen in the 1970s, I don't know why it would happen now.
I had a laugh a minute ago when you put buggy whips and fax machines in the same sentence, but it's absolutely fair. I mean, they're both relatively obsolete. Jeff in Ashland wants to know your reaction to Elon Musk's recent statement about the dangers of artificial intelligence, AI.
Yeah, you've got a whole range of opinions on this. I am not at the extreme with Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking, both incredibly smart men. We certainly need to be paying attention. And we need to be worrying about designing artificial intelligence in a way that looks out for human interests. That said, am I worried about AI killing us and killing us all in a year from now or 10 years from now? No. But it's certainly something to be mindful of. And I think the efforts that we're seeing in the industry with a lot of the AI companies collaborating on coming up with ways to think about AI development to keep it safe, I think it's a great thing to see happening.
Well, a very provocative chat. I'm glad you had as much time as you could spend with us here. Steve Brown is the Bald Futurist. He'll speak today at Southern Oregon University's Stevenson Union at 10:30. He is the CEO of Possibility and Purpose, LLC. Worked at Intel for a long time. You can find him online at baldfuturist.com. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jeff. Nice talking to you.